This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. Professor H.J. Mackinder is here to comment on the capitals as they watch the machinations of two autocratic leaders, Xi Jinping of the Chinese Communist Party and Vladimir Putin of the Kremlin. We've looked at the conflict zone from the Kremlin's point of view. Xi Jinping going to Moscow. Professor, the puzzle here is, what does Xi Jinping, what does the Communist Party get out of this visit? What are they looking to achieve?
Well, many people in the West are not aware of what a desperate situation China is in. All I can say is that economically, all the indicators are going down. They're basically bankrupt. They can't service their debt. Unemployment is rising. Even communists are being laid off. Pensions are disappearing. Health coverage is disappearing. It's a very, very serious domestic situation, at least as bad as when after the Great Famine. But in those days, you had Mao, who was, of course, a completely awful man, but he had a kind of a prestige in China in those days, and he had power. So he could pull the country together. Xi does not have any charisma, but he wants to be tough, and he hates the West. So he's attracted by Russia, which he thinks of as being a great power, and which we should not forget has many of the characteristics of a great power, although right now they're not in the foreground. And I think he wants to be together with a real tough guy, and Putin agrees with him. And he doesn't, he's burnt his bridges to the West, such as they were. So I think that Xi, by disposition, what they say about him is that Deng Xiaoping, who's now definitely out, said, put economics in command, but Xi says, put politics in command. He somehow economics will take care of themselves. So he is abolishing all of the economic gains that were made in the last 40 years. In return for that, he's going to get Russia plus China, and that is a formidable combination. Now, our journals, particularly the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times, get the economics wrong. They imagine that China is snapping back from COVID. This is not true. If you look at the statistics the way a statistician would, you discover that the standard of living is falling and so forth. But if we think that our imposition, let us say, of sanctions on China is going to affect the alliance with Russia, because I can't imagine anything but that coming out of it. You don't give a huge state dinner to somebody in order to agree that you're going to be pen pals. I mean, you do this because something very serious is underway. And we overestimate the effect that our sanctions would have if we try to discourage China. Because if China can't import microchips and aircraft engines, neither of which they're capable of manufacturing themselves, that isn't really a political problem. She can manufacture explosives, shells, howitzers, etc. They're very abundant, and that would be what Russia wants. As for standard of living, for decades, the Chinese ate nothing but cabbage. And when I say nothing, I mean nothing, nothing but cabbage. They'd go get issued, you know, a whole bunch of cabbages and put them in some cold room or cool area, and then they would eat them for the whole winter. Maybe in the summer they might get something else, but that was the diet. They can tighten their belts in a way that we have difficulty imagining. Now, Xi wants to be a colossus, not remembered for his tremendous political and geopolitical influence, not for his transformation of China, although he's trying to make China into the first socialist country. But he's interested in military power. And if he's allied with Russia, his energy problems, which are besetting, will be solved by Russia. And likewise, his problems with food. The Russian exports can handle both of those things. And I would argue that beyond that, she doesn't really have economic concerns. He's pouring a lot of money into microchips and so forth, and they've done that before, but it just it's wasted. So if we impose sanctions, that will be very damaging to China's modern sector, but she is not really doesn't care about the money. He doesn't understand the modern sector. It's not going to affect China's military strategy. Furthermore, we have America speaking in two voices. All the president said was that we'll wait and see about the visit of Mr. Xi to Moscow. We'd been hoping that it wouldn't happen. And there's still a possibility that it might not, but I think that that's us whistling past the graveyard. Meanwhile, the Pacific Command and other voices, Admiral Long Aquilino, are loudly reassuring China, saying, we do not intend to contain the People's Republic of China, and so forth and so on. This is very mistaken. If we want them to stop, we should simply make it clear to them that there's going to be a huge cost. We're never going to win them over to seeing us as a benign power unless there's a change of leadership in China. But we're just still carrying the torch. We really, I think someone like Blinken really believes that China is potentially very important. And if he can just get a little bit more intimate with the Chinese leadership, that they'll realize that we're really friends that they haven't met yet, and vice versa. This, despite the very sorry record, the disastrous record of the Kissinger-Nixon approach, which is, although we have to have relations with China, no question about it, that was not the right way to go at it. And what China has done right now is to slam the door, and we shouldn't keep knocking. We should just come home and start rounding up the Chinese thugs who, under the control of the Ministry of State Security, are, for instance, beating people up in New York City. We ought to get rid of them.
The Great Wall of Steel, Professor. How do you hear that threat by Xi Jinping at the end of the National People's Congress? He says Great Wall of Steel, and then they boast about how he made peace between Tehran and Riyadh, how he's going on a peace mission to Ukraine. Do these things go together in Chinese culture? On one day you say I hate you, and the next day I say I love the world?
No, I don't think that this is a Chinese cultural factor here. In traditional times, China had rather consistent approaches, one of which was official pacifism. And although they did carry out genocide against countries they were conquering, and they did have wars, the official ideology was absolutely opposed to it. As to the idea of negotiation and peacemaking, this is a completely alien concept. And now it's highly inconsistent. This business of bringing Iran and Saudi Arabia together, Iran is a Shiite theocracy, and Saudi is a Sunni monarchy, having something like 1,000 princes. And these Persia and the Arabs, the Persians and the Arabs, have been at each other's throats since before the time of Muhammad. So the idea that the Chinese has somehow magically effected a reconciliation, I'm very, very skeptical about how that's going to last. And the peacemaking mission to Moscow, if you look at their 12-point plan, it's really laughable. It's full of internal contradictions. This is simply a way of trying to give people who don't want to believe that China is going to get involved militarily and align with Russia in a way that's dangerous, give them something that they can believe in. You see that really China's trying to make her name in the world as a an arbitrator and as a country that contributes to peaceful world order. And that's not true. I mean, if she was contributing to a peaceful world order, her relations, for instance, with the Philippines would be very different than they are now.
And the threats about AUKUS, the meeting between the three leaders, President Biden, Prime Minister Sunak, and Prime Minister Albanese, is that a sincere threat on China's part, or it felt almost ceremonial? They've been hostile to Australia so long. Is this fresh hostility, or is this out of the can?
I would say that it's out of Xi Jinping's can. In other words, if Deng Xiaoping, at the age of 100 or whatever he'd be, 110 or 100, no more than that, if he were around, this would all be anathema. Although he certainly was not a Democrat in any way, and he was the one man who ordered the Tiananmen massacre. No other high official was willing to go that far. So Deng had blood up to his elbows, but his understanding of his counsel was always keep relations with America good. So I think that it's really quite virulent. If you read, for instance, Foreign Minister Wang's speech at wherever it was, G20 or something, and the room was just speechless after they were silent after his speech, because never had any diplomat been so crude and abusive in a kind of high tony international meeting. I mean, it's just vituperative attacks on the United States. But that is a product of the Communist Party, and specifically of the faction in the Communist Party that Mr. Xi has control of. Now, there aren't any good guys in the Communist Party. There's not a single person in the Communist Party who understands what China has to do to get herself up and running as a modern country. But still, there are shades of gray. And Mr. Xi is far more anti-Western and anti-Western culture and Chinese chauvinist, and also more poorly educated than anyone we've seen for a while since Mao. And Mao was a man of great intelligence, although of no discipline or education, whereas Xi doesn't even have the intelligence.
Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations, 5 Capitals, 5 Points of View. We're headed to Brussels, where there's not only a war crisis, there's a banking crisis.
Aren't we going to Kiev?
Oh, beg pardon, Professor. I bypassed the adversary from Russia and China. We'll go to Kiev, where there's no banking crisis. You'd have to say there's a permanent war crisis. The banking crisis comes later, although I did note that the IMF is reconsidering what kind of loans it can extend to Kyiv, anticipating that there will be a day to rebuild. Professor H.J. Mackinder, we're headed to Kyiv. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.